I'm Ehsan. It's Friday, and this is the Friday Show. It's been another busy week in City World, but I think the last busy week for a while, because there isn't a midweek game next week, which will definitely feel weird when we get there. But before we get there, we get to look back on City's win against Brighton and Liverpool's implosion, amongst other things. Joining me, I've got Stefan and George Monick. Oh, afternoon, George.
Good afternoon, Ehsan. How's it going?
Yeah, not bad. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all good, especially after last night. Friday today, the sun is trying to shine. It's not raining, at least, and looking forward to the weekend and the Forest match.
Excellent. Stefan, you good?
Yeah, good.
Very good. Very good. So I'm going to start with you, Stefan. Liverpool, obviously, they lost to Everton in midweek after beating Fulham on, I think it was Sunday afternoon that they played Fulham. Does this constitute a collapse from them?
The results themselves, I would say it's all a bit hasty. However, the performance would worry me, wouldn't it? As a Liverpool, if you were a Liverpool fan, I actually thought they started okay against Everton, to the extent that they looked dangerous, but looked like they could concede as well. But what amazed me was, really, particularly after the substitutions, they just looked gone. And so then, you know, I guess we are into collapse territory. However, I have to declare that following Howard and Steve's podcast earlier, I did go and put some insurance money on Liverpool at 55-1, which I think is
wow.
It's ridiculous odds. You know, there is a chance. I actually don't think it's that outlandish. There is a chance that both City and Arsenal drop points at the weekend, and Liverpool got the easiest game by a mile. And then I think it might look quite different. So I don't see Liverpool as 55-1 shots from here. But, you know, in answer to your question, I think it was a startling second half performance that may suggest that there is a collapse.
Can I bore you with a cliche, Stefan? There are no easy fixtures in this league. That's my
no, but I think that's true. But I do think, and I'm a big, you know, most of my analysis on the run-in has not been centered on tactics or any of that stuff. You know, I look a lot at the fixtures, and of course there are no easy games, but there are easier games and harder games. And I would say that West Ham falls into a category that should be much easier than Nottingham Forest away, for example.
Well, it's definitely, I think that they've found themselves. Firstly, I'm not, personally, I find it very difficult to separate Forest and West Ham in terms of going, well, this game, this going here will be easier than going there. I think that they're both bad teams. West Ham are much higher in the table than Forest are. Although their form, West Ham's form is pretty appalling. And I think that the unsettling nature of the managerial stuff this week for them as well will probably end up feeding into the game. George, where do you stand? Do you think Liverpool have collapsed?
I don't know if I would brand it as a collapse, but they've definitely tripped and they've definitely fallen flat on their face a bit in the last few weeks. I think what we thought was going to be siege mentality has turned into a complete kind of anxious paranoia, really, from a mentality perspective from Liverpool. I think everybody thought they were going to, you know, ride out off into the sunset with Klopp holding the four trophies, but now it looks like he's going to be, you know, shuffling along into the dark night, holding that Carabao Cup. But I think their main issue is the midfield is not that good in this Liverpool side for me. And I think when you turn up to Goodison Park for a scrap, because it's not going to be a football game like, you know, we see in other fixtures. It's, you're turning up against Dyche's Everton in a relegation scrap. It's going to be a fight. And your midfield three is Curtis Jones, Szoboszlai and McAllister against Decore, Idrissa Garnaghay and James Garner. You're going to lose that scrap from the get-go, especially in a game that's going to be fraught with transitions. So I just think it's just baffling how Liverpool have allowed themselves to be in, you know, a title race without any scrap in the midfield, without that core that has been such a big part of Klopp teams over the last few years. And I think maybe I've not realised it until the back end of the season quite how lacking they are in that centre of the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, I also think, look, they've conceded first in, I think, against Everton. That's the 22nd time this season that they've conceded first in a Premier League game. They can't defend for shit. I think that as much as they're, and whether that's a kind of structural thing where the whole team can't defend, or whether it's just the individuals in the back line. But I mean, I don't know if you've seen the clip of Trent and Dominic Calvert-Lewin that's done the rounds since Wednesday. But look, objectively, that is truly, truly, truly appalling defending. Like,
oh, the marking from the corner. Yeah,
it's just
crazy.
It staggers me, because that's not, I don't think they're complacent. That's arrogance. Without question, that's just arrogance. My take on what's gone on Wednesday is very much that they've turned up there going, well, we'll beat these because these are shit. And it doesn't work like that. It genuinely doesn't work like that. If you don't come with the right mentality, if individually you don't do the right thing, you'll get turned over 9 times out of 10. So I'm very unsympathetic to what went down on Wednesday night. And the other thing that kind of really grates on me a lot is this kind of prevailing narrative that is beginning to seep out from the Scouse mouthpieces that, oh, well, they were overachieving anyway. And, you know, it was not really, this team, this squad, it's not really good enough to win a title or to be in a title race. Look, when you get to here, you get to 5 games left. Come on. Like, that's pathetic. Do you know what I mean? And it's not like they've come up against Peak City and dropped points and had to go and play Arsenal and drop points. They've come up against one of the worst Everton teams I've seen in the last decade. They've come up against a Palace side that had got shipped how many to City the week before? 4 goals to City the week before? They've dropped points really in really bad places. Really, really bad places. They're absolutely not in a position to make really pathetic excuses like, oh, just, you know, was it a year too early or it was an overachievement? Whether or not it's an overachievement, once you get to that position in the running, you just got to win your games. Do you know what I mean? I'm just not having the overachievement thing. Do you think it was an overachievement, Stefan?
I think for parts of the season, yes. I think that they did have a period where they had a lot of injuries around the Carabao Cup final. And so there was an element of overachieving, in my view. I mean, you know, let's not forget, they were very good against us with a side that on paper shouldn't have been very good against us. And whilst I think that it's fair to say there's been a big drop off in players like Szoboszlai and also McAllister, and therefore probably they just didn't have the right balance. You know, I do think that they have done quite well with that squad this season. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think, if you lined up that squad at the start of the season, you'd have said, oh, these guys can take City really, you know, can really take them to the wire. I certainly didn't think that was possible. I agree. Obviously, they've slipped in the last couple of games very, very badly. You know, Everton are not a relegation team. We should remember that. They're actually a side that, with the extra 8 points, would be quite high up in the table. So they're not completely terrible. despite having some terrible performances. So I don't know. I'm a bit torn. I think they, you know, I think Liverpool have, they've had a lot of injuries, and it has been a difficult season in terms of transitioning from an older set of players to a new set of players. I don't think they're there. And then you've got the situation with the manager, and you just don't know how that affects a dressing room. It doesn't look like it's gone down very well. And I did think it that it was startling, that clip of Trent. So I'm a bit torn. Look, it's not completely dead. That's why I said about the 55. I mean, you know, they can easily win. They can easily get 2 points back on both teams. And if you look at that league table with 2 points back, the only thing that really says Liverpool are dead is the fact that their fixtures look really quite nasty. If you once you get to the last four, they still have Spurs at home and Villa away, which, you know, to win both of them looks tricky. But not, you know, not impossible. So I don't know. I still remember the City game, and things could have looked quite different. So I wouldn't be so quick to go all in on them, to be honest, as much as I'd like to.
Do you think the fact that the slot news broke on Wednesday had an effect on that performance on Wednesday night?
Look, I think it's hard to know, and hopefully we don't see it soon, but I think it's very hard to know the impact of a new manager and how players react to the prospect of your old manager walking out and a new manager coming in, whether it's a distraction, whether it takes 5% off your game. You know, was that something to do with the performance against Everton? Do you automatically kind of lose a dressing room the moment that the visualization of that manager walking out the door is there in your heads? Do you just try that tiny bit less than you would do if it was old Klopp? I don't know, you know, but it's probably a coincidence, but the overall 5% that they've definitely not had in the last few games probably is connected to Klopp leaving. Whereas you would have expected it to give them an extra 5%. You know, maybe when things go wrong, it takes away 5% and you just can't find that 5% back to get yourself into the game. That's why I keep coming back to how amazing it was in really all of these games. You know, Palace, Atalanta and Everton, that there was just no kind of massive reaction. Against Palace, they could have conceded again. Atalanta, they did concede 2 and 3. And against Everton, if you think about it, they barely looked like scoring in the second half after the first 5 minutes. And the substitutions were a disaster. So, yeah, maybe it's had an impact, but it's just very, very hard to know what that impact is in the dressing room, aside from our experience at Wembley with Mancini, which, of course, was totally different.
Mm. I guess I land in the place where I just think that in terms of if you look only at results, it's one thing, but Liverpool for much of this season have relied on certainly if you look at post the Klopp announcement, there was a lot of very emotional wins, a lot of games that went to the wire, including Sheffield United. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like they were bowling teams over. They were having to go to the well for 90, 95, 97 minutes. And then I guess the thing is, maybe you just run out of, maybe it just gets to the point where you're like, fuck, you know, we got to do this again.
Well, I think you run out of luck as well. But I'm pretty sure that the stat on City was before Brighton, it was 10, going behind in 10 out of the last 13.
Yes. Yeah, we can see
away from home. Away from home. Yeah, so, you know, we've had our own version of it. So, I don't know. You know, what do you make of that as well? I mean, that's not on the face of it brilliant either.
No, but I think I think 22 games is an enormous number.
It is an enormous number.
Particularly when you're looking at the home games as well. I think that, you know, it does maybe speak to a little bit of a look. As I said at the top, I just don't think that they're defensively as good as Arsenal or City. Not.
Well, I always thought it was weird that Konate thing. You know, like people rating Konate. Always thought it was weird, and now they're kind of. It is now established that he's basically Mangala-esque in his ability. But I was always in this like kind of weird world where I was like, what are they seeing in this guy? To me, he looks like quite a clumsy, you know, like slow on the ball type defender that's been bailed out by Van Dijk. But as, you know, you start to think Emperor's New Clothes, like, okay, well, if everybody says he's amazing, maybe he is.
Mm. And I think, you know... I personally don't think it's a coincidence that Connor Bradley's got injured and gone out of the team. Happy Gilmore goes back into the team and they stop winning games, because I think Trent Alexander-Arnold is that bad. I think he's a terrible, terrible defender and a terrible right back. He shouldn't be playing in that position, because he may as well play with three defenders rather than four, because he doesn't have anywhere near the intelligence or the intensity or the commitment to be a right back. I think
what in the previous seasons Liverpool have relied on with Trent being allowed that free role from right back is that the other three defenders are all at the very top of their game.
Yep.
Whether that's Van Dijk and Matip, Van Dijk and Gomez, and Robertson as well. And this season, none of them have been at the top of the game. Van Dijk's been solid in moments, but it says a lot against Everton that, you know, Trent, Robertson and Konate were all hooked when they were losing a match. Three defenders. And it's and they've chopped and changed the back line all season. And when you do that, when you've got no foundation behind Trent to go push forward and, you know, all his crossfield passes and pushing up the pitch, then he very quickly gets found out. And, you know, that clip kind of sums it up in a nutshell, really, the going challenging for Calvert-Lewin for that header where he basically, it's not even half-hearted, it's, you know, it's abysmal. It's abysmal.
It's very weird. I mean, that clip is weird, I think.
And you know what? The funny thing is that, like, so it's the derby. It's the derby that you need to win to remain in the title race, to win the Premier League title in the last season of this manager who you say has changed your career and made you the footballer that you are. And you were the lad who stood on the bins outside Melwood and watched training. You are as scouse as they come. And then you show that lack of commitment in that moment. It's really, really appalling. I can't get over how bad that piece of play is. There's not enough. You can ping 80-yard balls onto a striker's foot all afternoon. If you defend like that, you can't be a defender. You got to play somewhere else on the pitch.
He was pinging beautiful balls, I have to say. I mean, there was two or three. There was the through ball that led to the, what's he called? Nunes chance, which was an amazing pass. And there was also another cross, which was also amazing. So obviously, he does have he has some real quality. But defensively, I mean, it's not new, is it? Right? We've known for a long time you can't defend.
Yeah, definitely. Right. From the ridiculous to the sublime, City played Brighton last night. Stefan, were you nervous going into the game?
A little bit. But I think it goes to what Lloyd's been talking about in terms of injuries. And I did say to him when he was complaining about our injuries that we've actually had some quite good luck on that sort of stuff this season, where the opposition have a lot of key players out. And I think there's no better example than Brighton. Maybe Luton and maybe Villa. So, you know, we've had a few. We've been fortunate like that. Brighton is not Brighton that we've sort of come to fear, because you just had so many good players out. So I was nervous, but, you know, I thought that we should have enough to beat a team of that quality on paper. I actually probably got a bit more nervous after maybe 5-7 minutes because it was the shape of the game was actually quite different from what we've seen before.
Yeah. When the lineups came out, George, did that elicit a reaction from you?
I was quite surprised. The team to me looked as if, you know, we were the team I would expect Pep to put out in a very nervy kind of Champions League second leg, quite conservative, control-like. The additions, you know, of Kovacic coming into the side. No Doku was a big surprise for me. Obviously, in the reverse fixture, he was electric, albeit he was up against the 86-year-old James Milner for one half of it. But for, even when they hooked Milner off and they replaced him, he was still a threat all that game and was creating loads of chances. So I thought, maybe a little harsh, he doesn't start. And then after the first kind of 5 to 10 minutes, I was thinking, oh, we may need something different. But then again, I'm proved wrong by Pep as often when I question his team decisions. And so I would have liked maybe Doku to start just because I think he's in form at the moment. I think he would have been effective. But it turns out that Pep was playing, you know, wanted to pack the midfield out to stop those transitions and all that kind of stuff. And it was a very, very solid lineup in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was curious because obviously it was pretty clear just from the lineup that Walker and Gvardiol were going to be really high and really wide. And then, as Stefan said, the first 10 minutes were... So I did a podcast this morning, which is a new thing we're going to do on the 93-20 player called The Hub, which is a little bit more of a kind of analytical look at games and players and blah, blah, blah. But we discussed the game last night and Bailey pointed something out, which I hadn't really noticed, which is that... So what happened is in the first 10 minutes, it takes City 7 or 8 minutes to figure out how to deal with Brighton's press. And how they end up dealing with it is Akanji and Ake split really, really wide. And so Rodri and Kovacic drop really deep, almost into centre-back positions. And that then allows them to get on the ball. And from the moment that we make that tactical adjustment to their press, we begin to dominate the ball and we begin to find it much easier to progress it and move it into their final third. excuse me. So the opening goal, I mean, wow, what can I say? Like I felt from 10 to 15 minutes, I felt as though we'd got a grip on the game and I felt as though, all right, we'll from here, I can see a path through to us opening the scoring, but I definitely didn't have Kevin De Bruyne diving header on my bingo card. Stefan, what did you make of that opening goal?
I mean, it's almost a placed diving header. I mean, it's just a brilliant goal. I mean, you know, half chance, quarter chance? It's not a good chance, right?
No. No, so, super low XG, super, super low
XG. It's just a brilliant goal. And so important, that stage. I mean, everything changes when you score a goal like that.
Mm.
And, you know, it's not a coincidence that it's KDB. So often these big goals just, you know, it's not a coincidence.
No, absolutely not. I think I think any conversation around him leaving this summer, I just find it very unsettling and very difficult to even contemplate. I think that he is still the best player in the Premier League, and it's mad to have a conversation about how it might be good for City to get rid of the best player in the Premier League. That just doesn't make any sense to me. But the second best player in the Premier League was the lad who got the pre-assist on that goal. George, what do you make? How do you think Phil and Kev dovetailed in general, and what do you make of his part in that goal?
Yeah, it was really, really beautiful stuff from Phil. You know, with that pre-assist for the first goal, dropping, you know, slightly deeper, picking up the ball, left side leaning dribble, and then the through ball to Walker. So just so effortless from him, and you know, it was like we were seeing number 21 out there again. David Silva just, he puts it on an absolute dime for Walker. And then Walker, credit to him, actually finds his man with the cross, which is not something we can say every week.
I bet he went home and bought a lottery ticket, do you know what I mean?
And not only did he get one assist in the match, Walker two. So anybody who put money on that beforehand, I bet the odds were bigger than 55-1 for that. Definitely. Two Walker assists in a game. But yeah, it was a really, really lovely goal. And as Stefan says, the header from Kev is, it's ridiculous. He has more actually with his head than I do with my feet. So it's, yeah, it's ludicrous. But yeah, Phil was sensational for the first goal. And he really is starting to find a proper rhythm, you know, with whilst playing with KDB as well. The interchanging of positions when one comes in centrally, one will swing out wide, all that kind of stuff. And I think next season, I think we will see Pep kind of start them from the off, maybe together centrally more. I don't know if this season, I think he'll just stick to, you know, the rhythms that he's been playing with all season. But I think next season we will see that more. And also kind of the interchanging with Pep, with Kev sometimes, you know, switching out to the wings for periods of the game, for crosses, getting open, that kind of stuff. But I think they're linking really well, and they seem to, you know, they're interviewed together off the pitch. You see the admiration Phil has for Kev, and also you see, you know, that reciprocated from Kev towards Phil. You know, he really likes him, really looks after him, and what a great mentor to have for when you're starting your career in the centre of midfield.
Definitely. Stefan, where do you land on the Kev and Foden central conversation? Like, are you asked? Do you kind of... Because obviously, like, Kev, I think, is the best player in the league. And so, in a way, it's like, well, it's hardly a hardship if Phil has to go and play on the right wing. But you see the impact that he does have when he's playing centrally.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on it. The problem is, you don't know what version that you're going to get of Kev these days in the middle. On the pitch. And I know what you're saying about you don't want to sell him and everything else, but we can't ignore the fact that he's had a run of games where he's been pretty mediocre and not been at his best. And when he's not at his best, and then our other absolutely critical player and potentially defining player is tucked out wide, I think it does have an impact. So I don't know. It's a very difficult situation because I do want to see Phil central. I do think it makes a massive difference. I do think he's probably, with all fitness included, more consistent than KDB is at the moment. I'm sure you'll disagree with that. But so it's not ideal. But, to be honest, it's like when the team came out yesterday and everything you were saying, it's impossible to try and understand Guardiola's decisions on this stuff. Mm. So I trust him to make the decisions because logically, most of these sorts of 50-50 picks or the stuff, and if you look at that team, you try and look at the team over the last two or three games and try and work out how come he goes for Kovacic last night and doesn't go for him at Wembley at all. What's going on there? So, look, bottom line is I trust Pep to make that decision as we go. But I do think it makes a difference to us not having Phil central. But what do I know?
Yeah. I don't disagree with you. I think where I've landed on it after Phil's performances this season is just that, a little bit like George said, next season, I don't want to see Phil playing right wing. And the only way to stop that is to go out and buy a right winger who you trust and play him on the right wing. That's the way through this. The idea of Phil not being able to play with Kev in central areas, if Julian Alvarez can play in central areas with Kevin De Bruyne, then Phil Foden can play in central areas.
Yeah, but it's certain games, isn't it? You know, there's definitely a bunch of games where there's no problem. right? They can play together in the middle. It's not, there's no debate. There's no real risk. It's fine. But then there are the team, you know, the category, or, you know, category A games where it's not quite that simple. And I do think we are still going to have that issue. If they're both at the club next season, I do think in those category A games, we are still going to see the issue where he's just not comfortable playing both of them together. So, you know, I trust his decision on it. It seems to me to be a bit over the top, but I do trust him on it.
George, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, it's... I think that Kev will play... I think he'll stay, but I think he'll play less football next year. I know he's not played much this season, but that's due to a big injury. But I just think he will be rotated more if he stays next year. So I think, therefore, we will see Phil playing centrally next season loads more anyway. But then, as Stefan says, those category A games, those top six matches plus, you know, knockout stages of the Champions League. Do I see Pep playing those two centrally and not more, you know, more of a kind of traditional, you know, holding midfielder / possession midfielder? I'm not so sure as well. I think we'll see them start together in a lot of Premier League matches, but yeah, I think he may play a Kovacic or somebody else in with Rodri, and then one of them in the midfield. And I think it'll probably go with Kev sticking in the middle in those big matches, just because maybe, you know, he fancies Foden's pace out on the right more than Kev's.
I doubt he's going to sign a right winger. I mean, this summer, unless somebody goes, I don't see.
If Bernardo goes, maybe.
I think if players go, then
Bernardo to go, and so from what I've heard, the two main focuses for the summer window are a right winger and a central midfielder.
Where's Bernardo going?
They think he's going to leave.
But it's the same situation we've always had. I mean, they think he's going to leave, but the number of clubs that can buy him is extremely limited, and I don't. You know, Barcelona, you can take off the list, in my view. I have been wrong before on some on them, but I don't see how they can afford Bernardo. And PSG, again, from a financial perspective, is a complete mystery to me. So beyond those two, maybe Bayern Munich, maybe, I guess. But where else is he going to go?
Yeah, but isn't that I'm not being... I'm not being facetious here, but couldn't you just basically make that argument about any good footballer? Like, the reality is that if you're talking about lads that play at top clubs or lads who are top players, well, of course, the market is very small and very limited.
Yeah, but presumably the market on Bernardo does not include any Premier League teams. So
you've got a buyout, so technically it's down to him.
Oh, well, okay, but I'm assuming, and this might be wrong, I accept that, but I'm assuming that Bernardo is not interested in staying in the Premier League.
I agree.
Right, I agree. So once you get to that point, then it's not like any player coming from anywhere else. And furthermore, he's 29, 30. So is he even 30? I don't know. I mean, how old is he?
I don't think he's 30 yet, Stefan.
No, he's not 30 yet, no. Yeah, 28, 29.
He's 29, so he's 30 in August. So I think, look, the number of teams that are capable of buying him are very, very small. Maybe Atletico Madrid could be tagged onto that list. Maybe that's what he wants to do. I don't know. You know, obviously, there is a likelihood, there's a possibility that he goes. I think the reality versus the possibility are not quite the same with Bernardo. It's not a normal situation. But anyway, we'll see, you know. I'm hoping that we don't have the whole summer dictated by whether he's going or not. It's so, so annoying. I mean, so distracting.
It's also one of the strangest things, because every summer, you know, it is debated and nobody seems to come in and pay the money that's required. And yet the proof's in the pudding of how good a player is and how effective he is.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the more baffling things that, you know, we've got Barcelona saying that they leaked it to the press that they don't want to meet the 50 mil release clause. I think they want to pay for him with like a Twix and a bottle of Diet Coke or something. They're trying to haggle down to 30, 40. And, you know, obviously, he's got a release clause.
They're not going to have
50
that.
For a reason.
Yeah, no, they're not going to have that. He just signed a new contract. Like
exactly.
The whole point of that contract is to fix the fee at a reasonable level for
all parties. Yeah,
for all parties. So the idea that City are going to negotiate below that, I find quite laughable.
I honestly don't think they've got the money. In any event, they're not in the. So they went out early. So if you look at versus budget, they went out early in the Champions League. They are not in the club. World Cup. I mean, that those two things together are a swing of about 100 million euros, right? They've had their big deal selling off for the fourth time. I mean, a deal so complicated that nobody even bothers to even write about it anymore, right? You literally need to be, you need to be a 25-year lawyer, capital markets expert to work out what's going on. And as somebody that's got 25 years experience of both of those things, I still can't work out exactly what's gone on. So nobody knows anything about that deal. So I just don't see how Barcelona. Oh, and by the way, they've also had a whole season with half an attendance because they're playing in that in the B stadium. So again, huge impact on their bottom line. I just don't believe it. I don't believe that they can buy anybody for 50 million, 40 million.
I don't think Barcelona are the... I think realistically, he's going to land at Paris, in Paris or at Real Madrid.
I was looking at Paris, though. I just don't see... PSG have spent something like something like £400 million since... year end. So their amortization bill alone is something like 220 million euros probably for this season. They've got a wage bill last season of 600, but let's say it's down to 500. So they're doing about €1 billion of cost on it's just the numbers are just so ridiculous that they're losing like 400 million euros a year.
Well, it's a good thing that NASA's the chairman of the ECA. Because,
it is, yeah. But at some point, you'd think, I don't know enough about how the politicking works at the top, but you'd think at some point somebody would be saying, yeah, I think you've had a good enough run here, and we are just going to have to do something about this spending. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, I felt for 2 or 3 years that they'd have to stop spending, but they haven't. It's that simple. And
they doubled down. I mean, yeah. This summer they lost all these players. Okay, they sold Neymar for 90 million euros. Okay, so got bailed out by the Saudis. Fine. Okay, and they got 40 for Verratti as well. Fine. So they'll make a chunky profit. Because both of those players didn't have high book value. Fine. But they went out and just spent like crazy. I mean, people, you wouldn't even know most of the players. You might do because of your Paris connections, but people wouldn't even realize the number of players they signed in the last couple of windows. So I don't know. Let's see. I mean, they're also talking about Rafael Leao. That they're also going to try and sign.
We've done a massive digression here from the Brighton game, but what I'm interested in, because I've got you on the pod, Stefan, is so Mbappe is going to go this summer, right? Now, there is this kind of weird conversation about how he's going on a free, but he's not going on a free because he'd be owed 140 million euros as a loyalty bonus. And he's agreed not to take that. Is there a fiddle that the Qataris are going to do here to add 100 million plus to their books based on Mbappe going on a free?
No, I don't think so. I think that all of that's bollocks. If you look at what actually happened with, so there was a tweet from that from Cavey, the Sky guy, where he had obviously retweeted the full WhatsApp press release that had come out of PSG about why it's a great thing that Mbappe is going, right? He sort of tweeted it, including this nonsense about the cost. It's nonsense, right? All that's happened is he's not going to be paid money that he would have been due had he stayed. They're not going to get any money back. He's not paying them. He's not putting his hand in his pocket and saying, oh, here's 140 million euros back that you've paid me. Because he would have paid tax on that. And people don't unwind. And a footballer doesn't. Nobody signs a check to pay back 140 million euros or whatever. It's some nonsense. It's all nonsense, right? I don't know what they... The PSG numbers, I have to admit, don't look normal, let's say. So it's very hard to know exactly what the truth is. But I suspect the reality is nothing more complicated than Mbappe is out of contract and walks out of the door and receives no further payment from PSG.
Yeah.
As opposed to some kind of convoluted, oh, actually, we're getting 200 million euros back. The savings are purely savings because if he stays, then he would have triggered all sorts of additional payments, as you would imagine.
Okay. So City's second goal against Brighton is a deflected free kick from Phil Foden that he wins by aggressively running at them, which is something that I think has been a feature of him when he's played centrally this season, is how aggressive he is as a runner and how effective that can be for City as well. But I'm gonna fast forward to the third goal, because Stefan, I think you tweeted after Brighton scored their third, that was suicidal football from Brighton. Am I misremembering your tweet?
No, I did. I because it was coming, wasn't it? Right. I mean, I think it's perfectly fair that certain teams where they've got extremely high quality footballers can play around and try and replicate what we can do. It did not apply to Brighton last night, either with the players that they had on the field or the way they were doing it or the way we were pressing. It was, they got a lucky escape a bit earlier and it was coming. And I mean, obviously I should have tweeted it before that it was coming, but it was just coming. It was just obvious that we were going to trap them at one point.
Yeah.
And we were I think the only surprising thing was that Phil put it in the bottom corner straight away and we didn't waste the chance. You know, which is amazing. And it was obviously at that point game over. But I thought it was, I mean, beyond naive from Brighton.
George, where do you land on this kind of, you know, the point that Stefan's making about the quality of the players that you've got versus that, or the quality of the opposition that you're facing, and the idea of, well, you're committed to your system, but then you know you're going to play Liverpool and you're going to play Arsenal and you're going to play City twice a season. And in those games, even a quarter of a mistake because of how they press is going to absolutely kill you. Would you change your system for those games, or would you almost use them as, you know, like a learning exercise, like a way of going, well, look, that's the level that you've got to get to?
I personally would adapt, but De Zerbi's mindset is obviously he fancies himself as one of the big boys, and he's maybe playing two games in one, really, the game on the pitch and also, you know, career-wise off it, because when Brighton lose, because the nature of, you know, the club stuff, you know, it's maybe in the news for a little bit depending on who they've played, but then people have forgotten by the next week. And if you get battered 4-0, it doesn't matter as much as if you're the, you know, City manager, Liverpool manager, and you've been battered 4-0. But then if he pulls it off against City, you know, and gets a result playing that way, he's going to be so lauded and so respected, and it boosts his stocks up massively. And also, I think, you know, the third element of his core belief is that he wants to play football this way, and he thinks this is the way that you win football matches. So he's never going to deviate from that. And I respect it to a degree, but as Stefan says, it's hard to do when you don't have the quality of players to pull it off. You know, they've got so many injuries, Brighton. You look at their bench as well, the players, he probably aren't fit enough to play. Enciso, Fati, Buonanotte, you know, two of them, Enciso and Buonanotte, fantastic last year playing that way. Fati is obviously a great player, not quite hit his stride probably as much as he wanted to at Brighton. But I think it's a mixture of both naive and commitment. I can't really criticise him for doing it because it's his core football belief, but it was obvious after before we scored that as soon as one of these passes, one player doesn't control it right or somebody misplaces it half an inch, that they were done for, and it was coming.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit on the fence with this. I can see why if you train in a certain way and you play in a certain way, week in, week out, why you would not change from that because you have injuries, because I think that's not that easy. I think if you look at, I don't think anybody can dispute that tactically Brighton are one of the best teams in the league. There's a reason why they're so difficult to play against. There's a reason why they had the success that they had last season. There's a reason why De Zerbi is being linked to jobs like the United, Liverpool and Bayern Munich job.
Well, let me ask you a question then. So let's say we go into last night's game and we've got an injury crisis and we end up playing Gomez at fullback and Calvin Phillips at the other fullback or centre half, right? Are you selling me that we should carry on playing the way that we play in terms of passing it around using the goalkeeper with Gomez and Calvin Phillips as if it's exactly the same as playing with all the other players that we usually play in those positions? Because that's just madness.
No, I don't think you can. I think that's a disingenuous comparison. The reality is that 90% of Brighton's players are being coached to play in that way. And
So's Gomez.
No, hold on, hear me out, right? So that if you look at the experience that the Brighton players get from playing that way, game in and game out, it's improved every single one of those players. If you're talking about lads who are playing less than 1,000 minutes for City in a season, you may as well be talking about EDS kids, right? And no, I think because there is a difference.
Barco, how many minutes has Barco played?
Well, it was his Premier League debut last night.
Well, there you go. And he's the guy that gets caught.
Yeah, but he's also technically one of the most sound players that they've got.
I understand that, but it's just asking too much of these players. It's just, anyway.
Yeah, but I don't see...
Fine. I'm glad they did it. I just think it's just, you know, it's just naivety to think that you can come up against us with all of our best forward players. Probably even stronger than our best set of forward players in terms of the press, because Alvarez is probably better than Haaland in that situation. And naively think you can just get away with it for 90 minutes. Anyway, great. I'm glad they did it, but it's a gift.
Would it shock you if I told you that the XG of last night's game was very, very, very tight? That the XG, I think it's somewhere around, City are somewhere around 1.1, 1.2, and Brighton are somewhere around 0.7, 0.8.
Well, I don't know about ours. I mean, you know, our goals were strange goals. We, you know, after we go 3-0, we don't play our normal game, so it's kind of irrelevant. In terms of them, I can't remember them having particularly good chances. So anyway, no, it doesn't surprise me because we scored from, you know, one gift, one deflected free kick and the header. And I guess most of the XG was on the Alvarez goal, which was a high XG situation. So, No, not really surprised. Doesn't really make... It was an unusual game. Once it's 3-0, the game's finished.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely go along with that. I think they're a funny team to play against Brighton because I see it slightly differently in the score finishes at 4-0, and yeah, in a way, City don't really have to do much after 3-0. But at the same time, it doesn't really feel like a 4-0 game to me. It's not like, you know, it's not like Brighton plays so badly that you watch that game and you go, oh, they got slapped there. It didn't really feel like that to me. Brighton don't have players as good as City's, and they've got a shitload of injuries, and maybe it kind of makes Barney Roney's point that, you know, what are they doing trying to play a plastic version of Pep's football when they clearly don't have players who are that good. But I do think that I kind of see the virtue in it as opposed to seeing the negative in it, because I don't think that in the end they are weird goals, and And if you don't score the weird goals, how does that game land? Do you know what I mean? So, but I guess we'll never know.
I don't know. I mean, we could, you know, I suspect we could have won the game.
Well, no, for me, we were always going to win the game after the opening 10 minutes, because I felt as though that's the thing with the kind of Brighton City thing, in that when it becomes that much of a chess match, to me, it's just about, all right, can you get it into the final third? Because if you get it into their final third, you'll find spaces just because of the way that they play as well. And as soon as we started getting the ball in at the final third, it felt like, yeah, all right, we'll get some joy here. So look, I'm going to use the second half very quickly just to run through some individuals. George, what did you make of Walker and Gvardiol playing so high and so wide?
I think I spoke earlier on in the season about how that kind of tactic and combination was frustrating me, because earlier in the season, you know, we were struggling to, you know, properly penetrate teams and get into the box, create high quality chances, and the ball kept on falling to either Walker or Gvardiol on the edge of the opposition's box, with them being expected to play the final ball, and we weren't having much joy with it for quite a while. And it's obviously a tactic that Pep's liking. He's continued to play it, and maybe he'll play it into next season as well. But I think especially Gvardiol has really, really grown into the role in the last couple of months. I think he's had a really great couple of months form-wise, both defensively and also, you know, pushing up into the final third, getting crosses in. Scott got himself a couple of goals now, two absolute beauties. And then even Walker has, you know, as I joked about earlier, you know, he's, last night he was getting some good crosses in, getting into the right positions. It's good to see. And I think the system is there. I think you do need some different options though, that we don't currently have. So, you know, there's a lot of chatter about Jeremy Frimpong at the moment, isn't there? He's playing in that kind of wing-back role for Leverkusen under Alonso. And I think, you know, formerly in City's academy as well. So if, you know, somebody like him in the position that Walker was playing last night, you think you would have even more joy going forward and create more. I think Walker's terrific, but I don't see him as the long, you know, as the answer for next season, is playing high and wide at fullback. I like him more as a pure defender myself. And I think you need someone with a bit more technical ability in that role long term. But I just don't know who that is. But I've been very impressed with Gvardiol's transition into that role, having played centre back for most of his career.
Stefan, Gvardiol, I know that you have not been a fan in the past. Is he winning you over at all?
I think he's playing a bit better. I don't get the hype. Myself, still think he gave the ball away too much last night. Defended a bit better than normal. Not than normal. He's actually fine as a defender. That's not right. I don't see what he offers going forward. But I'm obviously wrong. Everybody else seems to think he's fantastic. So I'm quite happy to be wrong. And he did okay, but I do think it was a penalty.
Yeah, no, it yeah. I'm on the fence about that one. I don't think it was a nailed on penalty, but if it had been given, I wouldn't have moaned about it. I think it'd have been a little bit of a fair enough type.
Yeah, I think it's a penner, but it's when, you know, at 4-0, what it's not going to change the game regardless if they score or not. So the uproar surrounding it, I find a bit strange, because it's not going to change the game in any way.
I'm just glad that we're still paying off the PGMOL, to be honest with you.
Oh yeah, of course.
It's very important in a tight running like this that you've got the referees union in your back pocket. Stefan, just staying with you. Do you want to give Akanji some love? I feel like Manu Akanji is probably the most underrated player in our squad, in that if he does one thing wrong, I see it all over my timeline. And yet he can go weeks, months being like, I feel as though he's been our most consistent defender this season, and he's just not really had a lot of love. So do you want to give him some love?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a point well made. I mean, he's so consistent. You know, doesn't have these crises where he collapses in games. I think he's brilliant. It's now a confirmed, absolutely massive bargain, given that he's now done this for, you know, two seasons.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good shout. you know, I guess he doesn't sort of stand out in the way that some other players do, even in his position. But there was even a little situation last night where there was a little break and he put the burners on and recovered as well, you know, just reminding everybody about his pace. So I think he's superb, yeah.
George?
Yeah. I've got a lot of love for Akanji. I think like everybody else, when we first signed him, it was a bit of a strange one. It's like, all right, we're signing this, you know, Akanji from Dortmund for 15 mil. We're going to quadruple his wages. He's going to be the fifth centre-back. And everybody think we're scratching their heads a bit, but, the, you know, Bürgerstein's, you know, shown why he you know, wanted to make that deal. And I think Pep's publicly thanked him for doing so. Obviously wasn't a Pep signing in the outset, but he's turned into a Pep player after the last few years. And any role he's asked to play, left, you know, centre back, right back, left back, midfield, he's you know, been terrific. And I think there's an argument for pound value, he's probably one of the best signings of the Guardiola era, really, in terms of, you know, money spent and what he's brought to the team.
Definitely. I would absolutely go along with that. Alvarez needed that goal, didn't he, George?
Big time. I'm a big fan of Alvarez, as, you know, as a striker, and obviously this season, probably not the season he thought it was going to be, playing a lot of it centre mid, and, you know, he's probably got the most criticism he's had in his short career so far, playing in that midfield role, and, you know, a lot of that's probably more on Pep than him. But when you're a striker, you've got to score the goals to keep people happy, and he's not scored a Premier League goal in, was it 14 games or something?
Since January against Burnley.
Yeah, since January, so it's a long time. I know he's not the starter week in, week out up front, but you'd expect a bit more return from him. And it's, you know, you want to see him do well because he grafts so hard and he's a terrific young player. And getting that goal is important, especially for this running, because we're not sure on the fitness situation surrounding Haaland going into the weekend, and then we don't know how long we're going to have Alvarez up top four. So it's very important that he just gets that goal, because once he's got that, then he's on the way to getting a few more.
Stefan, who was your man of the match?
Phil, I guess.
George?
I'm going to go with Mr. Kyle Walker. I've been slagging off his crossing and, you know, attacking output for a fair few years, so I think it's only right that I hold my hands up, you know, when he has a solid game, you know, defensively in the most part, and then sets up two goals. I'm going to give it to Kyle Walker.
All right.
Yourself?
I'm going to give it to Phil, just because I'm from Stockport and so is he. So, you know, every opportunity I get, I'm going to give Phil man of the match.
The SK agenda.
Exactly, the SK agenda. Right. The small matter of Nottingham Forest away on Sunday evening, the 4:30 kickoff. Stefan, will you be more nervous going into Forest than you were going into Brighton, or a similar level of nerves?
No, I think the Brighton plus Liverpool definitely reduces the nerves. I think the atmosphere could be quite a problem at Forest, though. It's a super important game for them. They've managed to get a bit of the world against us in with this whole referee nonsense. So, you know, could be tricky. You know, clearly need to keep them quiet early on, all of that sort of stuff.
All the hits.
All the hits. First goal, really important, even though it rarely is. With us. Look, we should win the game. And if we win the game, things are going to look very, very rosy.
Do you think that game shifts the kind of needle in terms of your confidence in us winning the title? Like, do you feel like if we beat Forest, then that's one hand on the trophy type of territory?
Maybe not quite one hand, but it definitely shifts it, because it's 20% of the games that are remaining and it's an away game. And, you know, we would have two homes, two aways. The homes are easy. You know, I with the best will in the world, I can't see us dropping points in the two home games.
Mm. Spurs away. What's the other away game?
Fulham.
Right, okay. Yeah, they're on the beach. I watched them against Liverpool last weekend.
So clearly it's an important game. But having said that, just to the flip side of it, is if Arsenal do win at Spurs, then they've only got United as being the really challenging games, because Everton at home last day, I would think, will be done. Bournemouth at home is straightforward, should be. And then just the United game. They only have three games after tomorrow, after Spurs. So look, we got to win the game, right? If we win the game, we are very close. I wouldn't say one hand on the trophy, but we are very close.
Mm. Do you prefer to play last, or do you prefer to play first?
Don't know.
Okay.
Depends what the result is, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's fair. George. Based on Thursday's team, what sort of team do you expect Pep to pick on? So who do you think comes in who didn't start on Thursday, and who can you potentially see dropping out?
I think Grealish comes into the side to start. Possibly Diaz for Ake. And those are probably the only two I think will change, and so maybe it would be Grealish for Kovacic with Bernardo playing in midfield and Foden on the right, or it would probably have to be Grealish for Bernardo and then Foden on the right again with Kovacic in the middle, but I can't see him not playing Bernardo. So yeah, I think Grealish and Diaz may come in, but outside of that I don't think there'll be a whole lot of changes. He might not even change those two either.
No, I agree. Go on, Stefan.
No, you go.
I was just going to say, I think that there's been a lot of chat around. I mean, we saw it in the build up to the FA Cup that it'd be a heavily rotated team. And I saw a lot of people saying that last night it'd be pretty heavily rotated. And actually see the running slightly differently. I suspect that every game is going to be as close to you or my 11 lads as Guardiola can get. And so I think, you know, Walker and Akanji definitely start on Sunday. Bernardo, KDB, Foden, Rodri definitely start on Sunday. I think the only change I can see is Kovacic out and Grealish in. And then in the back line, he's got a choice to make as to whether he brings one of Stones or Diaz back and shifts Ake out to left back. But that's, you know, you're talking about minimal changes, and really you're talking about that collection of players that I mentioned being the ones that are expected to go out there and win it. Sorry, Stefan, what are you going to say?
Well, I think he's got a taste for Doku off the bench.
Yeah.
Which is why he didn't start him. He easily could have started him last night. But I think to have somebody who can make an impact if things are not going well is something that is quite attractive, guessing, obviously. And then the other thing, I wonder whether Grealish just winds up the crowd too much, and therefore you're better off not starting him and not having that as being a spur for their fans to get going, you know, feeling hard done by when he goes down for a foul, all the booing, all the noise that goes with Grealish. It might be better to have Kovacic basically boring them to death.
I like it.
Do you know what I mean?
No, totally. Let me ask you a question then. Can you see a world in which we line up almost identical to last night in terms of Walker and Gvardiol high and wide, Phil and Kev as two tens, and then the screen of Bernardo, Rodri and Kovacic? Just, I mean, obviously they're a very different team to Brighton insofar as they will probably play with three at the back and two wing backs. It will be, it's potentially five at the back again. And I wonder whether he wants to overload central areas.
George?
I mean, I think what he'll be worried about more so, I think, with Forest is the pace element of if they play you know, Elanga, Hudson-Odoi, Gibbs-White behind Wood, because which they may do at home. You know, like Stefan says, if the crowd's whipped up and they've got those three on the transitions, that's what he'll be worried about. So maybe Pep will go conservative in that and try and, you know, put a cork in the middle of the pitch and try and just soak up all of their noise and aggression and then, yeah, just pass it round them and really bring the crowd down, bring them down, tie them out. And then, yeah, that Doku off the bench tactic in the last half hour, then maybe go for the kill later on. But
yeah,
I think, as you said, with all that's gone on at Forest this week, it's going to be a fast start. So I think Pep, what he'll be looking at is that first half of just don't let them get ahead. That will be his main probably focus rather than us going on and trying to attack them loads.
Yeah, I think you've got to look at transitions. You've got to look at how you're going to control Hudson-Odoi and Elanga, because I think that if you do that and you control Gibbs-White, those three, they're not going to have a lot outside of that. And I kind of agree. I wonder whether now, rather than going, well, we'll go at Forest and we'll blow them away, I wonder whether he goes, you know what, 0-0 after 30 minutes is absolutely fine. It might actually even be fine after 50 minutes, because you'd still fancy yourself to go and win it in the last third of the game. Right, gentlemen, that's enough Friday showing. I'm going to make you both make three predictions. I want a prediction for West Ham, Liverpool. I want a prediction for Spurs, Arsenal. And I want a prediction for Forest City. Stefan?
Oh, God, it's pretty much impossible. Let's say Liverpool 3-1.
Yeah.
Win. Arsenal 0-0.
Yeah.
City 2-1.
Okay. George?
I'm going to go with West Ham 2, Liverpool 1.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Arsenal 3, Spurs 1.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go with City 1, Nottingham Forest 0.
I'm going to go with West Ham 2, Liverpool 0, Spurs 1, Arsenal 2, and Forest 0, City 3. Right. I think that's everything covered for this week's Friday show. Stefan, thank you very much.
Cheers.
George, cheers.
Cheers, guys.
To everybody who listened, this was the Friday show. Loads more podcasts on the 9320 player, blah, blah, blah. All the usual stuff. We'll be back very soon. In the meantime, be safe, be well, and as always, up the Blues.